Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Mark Zuckerberg comes to the show and brings a guest, Melinda Gates. And they come back and they are wonderful. They are so nice. And I meet Melinda Gates and I'm thinking, I just played her husband in a, you know, almost a Broadway show. And I thought, should I say something to her? And then I said, I've got to.
Welcome to Fort Knox. I'm John Fort and Happy New Year. If you saw the Tony-dominating musical Hamilton on Broadway in 2016, chances are you saw Rory O'Malley light up the stage as King George III. I'll admit to being a bit of a Hamill fan myself, having binged on the soundtrack since late spring. And for my birthday, my wife surprised me with tickets to the show, and I've got to tell you, just from listening to the soundtrack, I wasn't prepared for the show-stealing presence that O'Malley brought to a very unique role. So I was thrilled to get a chance to interview Rory for Fort Knox. This podcast brings together rich ideas and powerful people and hopefully provides some inspiration for you to achieve your goals, which is an especially fitting theme for New Year's. O'Malley offers all of that. In our conversation, he brings a no-frills assessment of life as a Broadway actor, his prescription for achieving your goals no matter what your career, and a surprising take on why his Tony-nominated performance as Elder McKinley in the Book of Mormon turned out to be a liberating experience. You can also check out Rory's own podcast, Living the Dream with Rory O'Malley, which is on iTunes, of course. This podcast, Fort Knox, starts off a little bit different. I sent a driver to pick Rory up in Manhattan and bring him to CNBC headquarters in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, where we recorded this. As they say, hilarity ensued.
I don't know. Like, I just got the feeling that he was like, well, this isn't the usual guy who comes in to talk about the Dow. And he asked me why I was coming. And I said, I'm an actor. And he said, oh, what are you in? And I said, I'm in Hamilton. And he said, oh, is that about that family in New Jersey? And I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I don't know what family. Now, granted, I just moved to New Jersey 3 years ago.
Right.
But Sam must be deep in New Jersey.
Yeah, you don't know about the famous Hamilton,
New Jersey Hamiltons. Yeah.
But, no, he said that, and then he said, well, what channel is it on? And I got so excited because this man has never heard of Hamilton on Broadway, and it was almost like I had discovered a civilization that has been untarnished by pop culture.
You're probably torn between having to explain to him why Hamilton really is a thing,
right,
or just actually enjoy a ride in peace for once, somebody not asking you tons of questions.
Right.
About.
You do have that moment where you're like, do I tell someone that I'm in Hamilton or that I'm an actor in general, because people are wonderful and they have a lot of questions when you do something like you're an actor or you're in Hamilton. And I made the choice. I liked Sam and I said, hey, I'm in Hamilton and we'll see where we go. And he took the turn that I did not see coming. He had never heard of it.
I would not have seen that coming.
It was great.
I had the pleasure just days ago, 2 days after my birthday, of seeing Hamilton.
Yeah.
Seeing you in Hamilton. This was my wife's big birthday gift to me, because she knows not only have I been listening to the soundtrack for months and months, but then I read Ron Chernow's biography on George Washington.
Right.
Didn't want to read Hamilton because I was into it. So go a little to the side.
Sure.
Then a biography on Thomas Jefferson because I kind of wasn't liking him after.
Yeah.
It's just overwhelming, the amount of history and then the artistry that's brought to the production. I mean, you've done a lot of stuff. Book of Mormon,
right.
Tony nominated for that. You've done a lot of TV also. How is Hamilton different, and how did it come to be?
Well, you know, it's a very different show, first and foremost, because nothing like it has ever been written. You know, it's literally taken the art form that I've dedicated my life to and love so much and brought it to a new height, to a place that it's not just that we never thought it could go there, it's that we didn't know it was capable of doing that.
Now explain, because you actually know Broadway and you know musicals, so is it the hip-hop component of it, the fact that almost the entire show is rapped and sung?
I think that it is, yes, but I think that it's the fact that the entire show is pretty much in rap, hip-hop, or sung, and my mom doesn't notice. That, to me, is why the show is so successful, is that my mom from Cleveland, Ohio, can show up. And she said she was worried about all that rap, if she was going to understand anything, but she said, I think they were singing. I said, yes, they were. You know, she doesn't know exactly what hip-hop is. Yeah. And I think that that's what the great power of the show is that there's so many different entry points for different people. When I saw it, I said, this is the greatest show ever. I love it. I don't know if everybody else is going to love it because I think this show was made for me.
When did you see it?
I saw it at the Public Theater downtown before it opened. And I said, well, that's the greatest thing ever written. And if I get to be a part of this in any way in my lifetime, I will be so grateful.
You were thinking that even then?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm an actor. You're always looking for something. When you see a show, you're like, all right, where's the eventual part I could audition for? And, of course, Brian D'Arcy James, who originated the role downtown.
Of King George?
Yes.
The third.
He was absolutely a genius. Absolutely. He is. I've seen him perform so many times, and he's spectacular as an actor. And I was living in Los Angeles, and I went out and got the cast recording when it came out and, like, binged it and listened to it every single day. When I was going on a run or a hike, I was listening to My Shot. You know, I was a fan of the show before I was a part of it at all. I was a huge, huge fan. And I also went to college with Leslie Odom Jr.
Oh.
He was my classmate.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
At
Carnegie Mellon University.
Huh.
Yes. Yes.
And so I'm starting to see at least a connection here. But getting into the show must have been a long shot because you're a white guy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a white guy getting into Hamilton is like a black guy getting into anything else, right? I mean, there's only a couple of spots for you.
Yes. Yes. No, it's absolutely true. I think that, you know, with this role, they are always looking for the whitest guy. And that is my, basically, if there's any kind of typecasting for me, it's the whitest person who ever
I was in Book of Mormon.
Yeah, exactly.
From
exactly.
Ohio.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's definitely my thing, is being the whitest person ever. But yeah, it was crazy. And what's funny, this is the story. I don't know if you know the full story of how I got into Hamilton.
I don't.
But it's, I think CNBC listeners or watchers would be very interested in this. And I haven't told this story yet fully, the part that you will really be interested in. So I was living in Los Angeles, and I was sitting in a Starbucks with, again, I drink a lot of coffee at Starbucks, as I told you before. I was sitting there with Josh Gad, my buddy, who I also went to Carnegie Mellon with.
Oh, wow.
We were in the same class, Leslie and Josh and I.
In Book of Mormon.
We were in Book of Mormon together. And
did you guys all do shows together at Carnegie Mellon?
Yeah, we were in classes together. We did shows together. You know, we were from 18 to 22 every single day doing acting classes and
everything. And with Leslie Odom Jr. too?
Yeah.
Man, they should be like a TV series like on you guys in college. That would be...
That sounds great. They'll cast younger people. Great. Thanks, John. and Katie Mixon was in our class as well, who has a TV show on ABC called American Housewife, and she's insanely talented. She was on Mike and Molly for years. And yeah, no, we had a good group of people, and Carnegie Mellon really has a great program, not just engineers.
I wouldn't have.
It's funny, all the people who are engineers don't realize how great the drama school is, and all the drama people have no idea what engineering is.
They build the sets. What are they?
Right. Yeah. They have no idea. But it's a great school because of that. Because there's such diversity in what they teach and the kinds of people that are on campus. Hmm. So I loved going to school there. But anyway, I was sitting in a Starbucks with Josh Gad, and I get this email from my agent saying, oh, there's some Broadway musical that wants you to be in it. Here's an offer for a Broadway part. And this never happens, right? It was not Hamilton. It was called Nerds, the musical.
Right.
Had you heard about this?
Bill Gates
and Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
This new musical that was coming to Broadway this last year. And I had heard of it. It had been around for about a decade. And it got a theater, and they were fast-tracking it and getting it into the Long Acre on 48th Street. And this was a direct offer in an email on a Friday. Sitting next to Josh Gad, I said, I don't think this is real. This is very strange. They're asking me to play Bill Gates in a musical. And he said, you have to do it. Go right now. I was like, what? It's so... I call up my agent over the weekend, I get the material, and I'm going through it, and I go, you know, this is actually really funny. And it was this really, really broad comedy that was Bill Gates rapping and a lot of fun stuff that people who follow tech would have gone crazy for. But I show up, this is back in February, to New York City.
February of this year. Of 2016.
Of 2016. Oh, yeah. It's been a crazy year. A crazy year. So February 20th, I show up in New York City. My husband has a great job, actually working in a wealth management firm in Santa Monica. I come out here.
By yourself?
Yeah.
Leave your husband in Santa Monica.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He's just thinking the world of me. I'm like, I actually moved him out there because I got a TV show, and it lasted 10 episodes, and he got this great job because he's a real person. so we were like, you keep your job. Who knows how long this Broadway show will last? Well, we start rehearsals. 3 weeks in, we've learned the entire show. It's the last song before the bows, we're learning the finale, which is the lyric is, live your dreams. And the lead producer walks in and he says, everyone needs to go home immediately. One of our investors dropped out. We will not be opening on Broadway this season. And it was like someone walked in and said that there had been a death. Because it wasn't just, it was very sad. And it was, you know, it was tragic for a lot of people because their dream really was about to come true in terms of making a Broadway debut. So many people in that room. These are all incredibly talented, very young people who are going to have amazing things happen to them. But this was just one of those moments where there was no way to put lipstick on this pig. It was horrible.
So what do you say? Because you have been on Broadway before. Like
yes.
I said, Tony nominated. Mm-hmm. I mean... here's a chance for you to say something.
Yeah, right? But what do you say, John?
I don't know. What do I say?
You know what? It's funny. I understand what you're saying because I looked to the stage manager. I looked to the people who have been in my business for decades and decades and decades who knew every in and out of things that had happened. And I looked to them. I said, has this ever happened before? And they said, no. It's very abnormal for something like that to happen because a producer has to put up a lot of money to get everybody in a room. There has to be a lot of money already put into the production. A bond has to be given to the union. There's so many business things that are way above my pay grade that have to be in place. And so to get 3 weeks into a rehearsal when you've paid the theater 3 weeks of rent, when you've paid for an entire set, when you've paid for a cast, it's shocking.
Yeah.
I remember a lot of the time in those 3 weeks thinking, I don't know about this one. But I never was thinking, I don't know if we won't make it to the first preview. I thought, I don't know if we're going to last as long as Book of Mormon. You know, like...
Which was how long?
Which is still going.
Yeah.
Which, you know...
But you were in it for...
I was in it for 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah, the first 2 years. But anyway, you know, he walks in there and it was devastating to so many people. And it was very sad for me. But to the folks who really had put their heart and soul into it for years, to watch them have to go through that day was... It was one of the worst things I've ever experienced in my career, for sure.
But you don't jump on a plane.
Well,
and
I do.
Go back to you. Do
I do?
Oh,
yeah. So that was March 8th. I'm going to remember this timeline forever. I'm going to be a good journalist about it. And that was March 8th. And then our director, Casey Hushin, who is a wonderful human being, it was her Broadway debut as the director. She's been an associate on a bunch of shows. She said, I think we owe it to ourselves to all come into the room tomorrow and run through the show. And that's what we did. It was really difficult, emotional, and there was a lot of tears. But we ran through the show for each other and some friends. And the designers and the people who had been working on it for so long so that we could at least see what we'd done, have some closure. And I got on a plane, flew back to L.A. a few days after I packed up my belongings. And I remember my husband got me Bruce Springsteen tickets. And so I got to go see Bruce Springsteen. He had to cheer me up. And 2 days after getting back to L.A., my agent called and said, Rory, I know that you just had a really hard experience on Broadway, but would you ever consider coming back to Broadway? And I said, oh, I don't know. You know, my heart is just so broken after that experience. And she said, well, what if it's for The King in Hamilton? And I said, I'm at LAX. I'm on the red eye. She said, you need to talk to your husband. I said, no, he'll understand. I'm already there.
You were already there?
I literally left like within 2 days and was back in New York City. And was working on The King with the creative team. So it was crazy. And the reason that happened is that our wonderful casting director, she was, for Hamilton, is the casting director for Nerds. And so she was in the room that day watching that run through of the show that we had worked on for 3 weeks. And she said, you know what, Rory would be great in Hamilton as The King. And Jonathan Groff had just put in his notice and was going to do a Netflix show. Probably the week before, this show collapsed, and there I was. And within a few days, I was at the Richard Rogers rehearsing to be The King.
Now, that's amazing. I don't remember when Hamilton became a pop culture phenomenon.
Right.
But I'm sure you do. When was it more than sort of an indie Broadway circles inside thing? When had it exploded into the public consciousness of everybody's got to have Hamilton tickets, how do I get tickets?
You know, it's funny because I think I have a unique perspective on that because I wasn't in the show from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the show and the original cast, they talk about, and I understand it because of Book of Mormon, about being in a bubble. And that you just have to keep your head down and keep doing the show. And you don't really, you know that things around the theater are crazy, but you don't know what people in Oklahoma are interested in it or not. And I knew that once family members who had no knowledge of Broadway whatsoever were asking me about Hamilton, I thought, wow, this has really worked its way into pop culture and society in a way that Broadway shows just don't usually do. And I think that it was the cast recording. Mm-hmm. When that came out at the end of last year, I believe it was, that kind of is a cast recording that will go down as something that really changed Broadway history. You know, it's I think it's gone platinum at this point. Mm-hmm. And it really was a chance for everyone in the country to be a part of the show and listen to the show and get, and you know, all of a sudden people wanted to see it, not just listen to it.
So I got to ask, before I want to get into, you know, your career and you know, how you try to advise young people that maybe it's not exactly what it looks like.
Sure.
You know, it's great. But it's so unique to have a cast recording.
Yeah.
That becomes such a huge hit so early in a show's life.
Sure.
I mean, I know, I can't tell you how many times I listen to every song on that recording.
Yeah.
But I know, like, inflection on, like, every line pretty much that everybody says or
right.
sings. Now, when you're coming in after the cast recording has been recorded,
right.
how do you start to exist in a show like that, that probably a good percentage of the audience feels like if you sing a different note or sing it in a slightly different accent, they're going to know, oh, he made an interesting choice there.
Right, right. You know, I think that you can't worry about it because I think it's freeing. I think that it's actually harder for the person who is on the recording. Because they are supposed to be the robot who does exactly the same thing. For me, I'm liberated the first two notes from that. Hmm. I don't have to keep following along what Jonathan Groff did, because if I did, I would be terrible because I'm not a good Jonathan Groff. I'm a better Rory O'Malley playing this king. And so it's been interesting to originate a role, and that was so much fun with Book of Mormon. And then getting to step into a role that is insanely fun and that I've got to make my own. But you always are borrowing and recreating something that was done by the original actor. Mm. You know, that's why originating a role is what it is that it's the first time going on stage. You're the one who figures out what works in front of an audience. And everybody else is a different version of that. And especially with this, I think it's... In drama school, we had clown class, where everybody made up their own clown, you know, red noses and all, and yeah. It was this wonderful, fun study of creating really goofy characters. And one of my favorite parts of that class was when you traded clowns. So if we made clowns, I would be John's clown, you would be my clown one day, and you had to learn and observe what that clown was. And it's basically, it's writing this whole world, this character. And I kind of felt that that's what this was, that Brian D'Arcy James, Jonathan Groff, Andrew Rannells, the three guys who played and touched the character of the king, who wore the crown, they had contributed to the clown. And I was just doing my part of contributing to this clown and bringing it to the next person, if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So now I want to ask, let's say I'm 12 years old.
Okay.
And I want to be on Broadway.
Yes.
And I want you, Rory O'Malley.
So you're me when I was 12.
Yes.
Obsessive.
Except now.
Okay.
Except 2016, I'm 12 now.
Right, right.
And I want you to tell me, how do I do it? What do I have to, I mean, let's say I've got some talent. What classes do I have to take? What mindset do I
right.
have to have? How much is it going to cost me, or
right.
is it going to cost me? Do I have to? Where do I have to go? What camps do? What do I do, Rory?
Wow, it's a hard question because I think there are lots of ways to get to Broadway. There are people who went to conservatories. There are people who didn't. There are people who didn't go to college at all. There are people who went to conservatories in the best schools and are not on Broadway, you know? I would say, knowing what I know now and you know, where I am, I would say my number one advice to young people is to relax and to chill. Because if you are a
people
person...
People don't do that nowadays.
They don't. And I think that so many young people, especially ones who have a dream when they're 12, which is a wonderful blessing, but it's also very demanding on a 12-year-old to have a dream as big as Broadway, that you should be striving for excellence and education and learning and be open to whatever path that journey and education takes you on. On my podcast this week, I have one of our dressers at Hamilton, Chris Leary, who studied dance as a child, went to college for acting, and is now in the wardrobe department and loving every single second of it. And I think that his journey is such a good example for young people, because his journey's not over, but he's somebody who didn't close himself off from all the other opportunities and ways to be a part of art and creating. And this business is huge. There are so many different entry points into being a part of Broadway. And if you close your mind off to, I have to just be starring in a Broadway show or I won't have quote unquote made it, you're going to really miss out on a lot of opportunities. There are plenty of times where I thought that I wasn't going to be on Broadway. And I opened myself up to starting a nonprofit or working on an organization that I really cared about or doing something else or working, you know, in a side job that I thought was really great. And by letting myself lose that laser beam focus on just that one thing, my whole world expanded. And so I really encourage young people to be open to the journey and not just laser beam focus on the one thing.
So you implied that when you were 12, you wanted to be on Broadway.
I did.
When did you first figure out that you wanted to be on Broadway?
Well, I first figured out that I wanted to be an actor when I was 8 years old, and I was cast as St. Joseph in the Christmas pageant at Our Lady of Angels. Now, the director was the second grade teacher, Mrs. Gibbons, who also was my aunt. So it's total nepotism. It's always who you know in
helps,
this business,
yeah, right.
Even from the beginning. But I was not a lost kid, but it was funny because when I was on that stage at 8 years old, I felt like I had been found. I felt like something happened, and I knew that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And I sat my mom, an accountant at the same firm for 41 years, single mom, sat her down and I said, Mom, don't laugh at me, but I know what I want to be for the rest of my life. I want to be an actor. And she didn't laugh. She cried. And she was totally supportive, and she enrolled me in children's theater, Beck Center for the Cultural Arts in Lakewood, Ohio. And I went there for 10 years. It's where I met Krista, the producer here at CNBC.
Krista Braun?
Yes, Krista Braun. And so that community didn't just give me the tools to be an artist and an actor. It gave me an oasis and a place to be myself, to feel safe, and to create, and to be challenged, and friends. I didn't have a lot of friends before I met my fellow theater nerds. And
theater nerds are great.
They're the best.
I did some theater in high school myself.
There you go. I could tell.
Elementary school, John. And yeah.
I could tell you were one of
junior
us.
Junior high, I am. Did an opera, actually, but this isn't
wow.
about me.
Wow. Very nice.
Christmas also. I'm all in the Night Visitors.
Oh, nice.
So from 8 to 18, community theater, and then Carnegie Mellon.
Right.
And Leslie Odom Jr. happens to be same class or just
yes.
there?
Yes. So you can't get over this, John.
Yeah, I can't get over this. Because this is like.
Yeah, same class. We met each other when we were at freshman orientation.
What's your first Leslie Odom Jr. memory?
Well, he was in Rent on Broadway. So, oh my God, we were all like, well, what's he even doing here? What does he need an education for?
You mean
for?
Like at 18 he was in Rent
yes.
on Broadway? Oh my
yes.
goodness.
I know. I know. So, you know, my first memory of Leslie was just being in awe. And that, you know, I've known that Leslie had this amount of talent and was capable of what he just showed Broadway since he was 18. And I mean that. You know, sometimes somebody can, like, grow and you're like, oh, my gosh, I never knew that they had that in them. Well, that's not true with Leslie. Like, Leslie has always been astounding, and it just took the right part to match his talent. And boy, did those two things match in the right time.
Interesting. So what did you pick up for your craft at Carnegie Mellon that you hadn't gotten earlier on. And tell me how that led to whatever it was that you did next as soon as you got out.
Stamina. I think that the amount of work that you're given at Carnegie Mellon is overwhelming. And you are constantly in class, building sets, memorizing a project for your next show. You are always working so much, and it feels daunting. And then you get out of school, and your work is at a restaurant. Your work is at many different side jobs. And I feel like Carnegie Mellon prepared me and gave me the tools, not just to be a good actor, but to be a professional. And
meaning
that I was more equipped for the business side of the business than I think a lot of other paths would have made me.
And how did Carnegie Mellon prepare you for that?
Brought in a lot of professionals to talk to us about the business. Tried to be as, and, you know, and really the best education is just being out there. You can't really teach everything until you just have the cold water thrown on you. But I think that they have a wonderful network of support with other Carnegie Mellon students, recent graduates talking, and there's still alumni associations on both coasts that are very active and supportive. I think they call them the Carnegie Mellon Mafia in our business sometimes. It's a great school, but it's an even better support system once you leave. And my classmates, I learned most of what I needed from Leslie Odom and Josh Gad, Katie Mixon, and the other wonderful members of my class.
So what's your first big break, if it can be termed that way?
Sure. Well, I worked for the late, great Mr. Gary Marshall for years out in Los Angeles. I did Happy Days the musical for him, playing Richie Cunningham. Richie Cunningham.
Yeah.
I hope you can see it.
I can see it.
in my younger days, especially. But I worked for him for years, and it was one of the greatest pleasures of my life, and I'll always try to be like Gary Marshall. He was just a fantastic human being and made everyone a family. He was just wonderful. So I worked for him for years out in Los Angeles and then on the East Coast. But I worked a lot of side jobs, overnight shifts at hotels, serving. But the best job I had, and this is absolutely true, and the one my mom is probably still most proud of, is I worked at BlackRock Financial for 3 years.
3 years?
3 years as a temp. And I worked for their human resources department. And it was amazing.
Why
was
that amazing. The best?
Well, one, they were just really good to me in terms of being able to go to auditions. And I got that job, and a month later, I got my Broadway debut, which was the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. And I realized how good of a job BlackRock was, so I kept it while I was doing Spelling Bee. So I would do the show at night and come to work at BlackRock during the day. And of course, I had to miss a lot of work at BlackRock, but they were like, we'll work around this, we'll figure it out. And I think that they really brought in a lot of actors into that human resources department. And I think Carnegie Mellon on my resume didn't hurt.
Right, right. But
it's funny because I would, have to work with a lot of first-year analysts. And a lot of them were from Carnegie Mellon, not the drama department. And when they would find out that I went to Carnegie Mellon, they thought this is their in for their interview. And they would say, can I get your email? And my email at BlackRock was temphr2. I wasn't even one. So I was too embarrassed to give them my email at BlackRock, so I would give them my AOL account, which at the time was Roar Dog 1999. And I remember very clearly having to spell out Roar Dog for a Carnegie Mellon engineering student, which is one of the low points of my life. But it was such a great experience because I went to Broadway and was there for 5 months, and then I needed a job, and BlackRock was still there for me. And I was able to work there for years. Many of the BlackRock people have come to see me in Broadway shows. I just did a solo show at 54 Below, and one of the people I worked with there came. It's just been, I can't tell you how much it means to an actor to find a supportive side job, a supportive job that really finds ways to take your talents and make use of them and also supports what your future endeavors are. And it allowed me to give fully to them. And I was working like 50-hour weeks at some point. But my mom's still most proud of that, the accountant in her. So, but I was sitting at my desk at BlackRock when I got a call from my agent saying that the South Park guys and Bobby Lopez had written a new musical, and did I want to be a part of the first reading ever done of it? And I just dropped my phone, and I told the people in the office, I can't be here next week. And that was...
So that's how Book of Mormon...
That's how Book of Mormon happened.
Same agent?
No.
Okay. I won't go into that. But, okay, Book of Mormon. I'm no Broadway buff, like historian.
Right.
But the level of irreverence
right.
in Book of Mormon... It's like South Park level irreverence, but in a Broadway show.
Right.
What did you think when you went to that reading?
You know, it's funny because Bobby Lopez, the, you know, now Oscar winning Bobby Lopez, who wrote Frozen and wrote Avenue Q, he called my cell phone, and I was shocked that Bobby Lopez is calling me, and it was so exciting. And he said, we're doing this reading. I'm so glad you're doing it. There's a couple of songs that we want the cast to know what they are before they agree to do it, which was so nice because I think they really were scared that actors wouldn't say these things.
Right.
And the songs that he repeated to me like weren't even songs that I was going to be singing. They were, you know, Hasidi Gibwai and you know, a lot.
Right.
And so, you know, the translation of that,
right.
I'll let your listeners look that up.
Yeah, they can look it up.
But, he basically said the translation of that and what the song was and why they were doing it. And I was like, and you and Matt Stone and Trey Parker wrote it? And he was like, yeah. I was like, I'm in. Like, you're all genius. So I knew that it was going to be phenomenal, and it was definitely, like, overwhelming. And lots of people told us that it would not open on Broadway, that it was hysterical, but, you know, that nobody would put money into it. And I, you know, I kind of believed them. I was like, well, I don't know. What do I know? I'm just working at BlackRock Financial. And I remember, you know, just being like, this is amazing. It has to happen. Like, it's so smart and funny. And it was a three-year process of, it wasn't like...
3 years
three
from
years
when you
from,
got the call to when it actually...
Open on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Which is very fast for a Broadway show.
Really?
People think that, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Hamilton... took Lynn 7 years. I mean, it's Hamilton, but really...
That's from, like, when he started writing it, right?
Right. But, I mean, when you do that reading, there was probably, like, maybe 7 or 8 songs written of Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. So it was the first time they were hearing it out loud. And like I said, I think they were just trying to see if actors would say these things.
How much did it change?
I would say that I've been involved with a lot of readings and new shows that there were significant changes, but it was pretty much the show that they envisioned from the beginning. And I think that if you set out to write a show like Book of Mormon, you know what you want to do, and you're not like just trying to see what sells or what's going to please people. They know what they want to say when they start writing, and it just kept getting better. And that's not always the case when you're writing new things. Sometimes it takes, you know, left turns into nowhere. But it was an amazing experience for me. I started out just part, one of the Mormons in the ensemble. And by the end of the first reading, they said, the next time we want you to be this character who is running the mission when they get to Uganda. And then the next time I had a song, Turn It Off. And the next time I had a song in the second act, I Am Africa. And it turned into this role. And over that 3-year period, working with some of the greatest minds and satirical writers of our life. It was certainly one of the greatest creative experiences that I'll ever have.
So I'm pulling out a few nuggets here. You're talking about being open and not looking straight at the Broadway dream as being it for somebody who maybe wants to do that, and it's probably relevant to anybody who wants to do anything.
Right.
You're talking about the preparation that you got at Carnegie Mellon to think not just about narrowly about the craft, but about the business side of it, about all the other tasks that come into making the show happen. You've talked about the importance of having work that helps you to do the main thing that you're passionate about. Talk to me about how Hamilton, being in the cast for, gosh, what's it been now?
Nine months? Yeah.
How has that changed your career, your outlook, the incoming calls? Are they different, besides the people hitting you up for tickets?
It drowns out everything else. it has definitely changed me. I think that it's, on a personal level, it's given me more confidence, which my husband would be like, oh, great.
You seem like a pretty humble guy.
Yeah, well, I think that I'm from Ohio, I'm an Irish Catholic, and I'm always like, with Mormon, I thought, this is as great as it gets, I'm going to enjoy every second of this. And whatever else happens in life, in my career.
So you felt that way going in?
Absolutely. Well, I felt that way while Book of Mormon was happening.
Yeah, while it was. So when it was over.
Right.
Was that
weird? Look, the greatest thing for me about being in Hamilton is that I've already done the greatest thing I'll ever do. And so getting to be in Hamilton has no pressure around that. Like, people always would always say, when I would tell them, Book of Mormon is the greatest experience I'll ever have professionally, they'd say, no, great things are coming. And I'd say, I didn't say that. I'm telling you that this is the greatest thing.
Oh, they'd say it like, no.
Yeah, like, don't worry,
like you had
worry,
just said,
honey.
Your life is over.
Yeah.
Right. It's
yeah.
like, no, no.
No, like,
so for you, it was liberating. You didn't feel like you got to top it.
No, exactly. Like, it's not a bad thing to know when your dream comes true. It's not when it's fully realized. You know, yes, you have to dream bigger. Yes, you have to. But for me, that's, I'm going to have a baby one day. You know, like, I'm not going to have a baby thinking, well, oof, I wish I could have had that one time or something like that. And that is a gift. It's not how am I going to top Broadway experience of Book of Mormon. No. So to have Hamilton come along, where I know all the pressure that can come along with a hit and feel absolutely none of it, to just walk in and be like, this is a wonderful job, and it's a part of Broadway history, and it is absolutely a gift in every way. And to get to see it that way, because I had the Book of Mormon experience, and because I don't have any of that pressure of what does this mean and what am I going to have to do with this, it's amazing.
How do you stay hungry but be satisfied at the same time?
It's a very difficult thing.
And which it's side? Being satisfied or staying hungry?
Being satisfied. I think that you have to control your hunger. You don't get to being an actor without having an out-of-control ambition. You have to maintain it to be happy. And I did have to make a decision in my mid-20s if it was more important to me to be happy or working as an actor. And I know that those two things don't have to be one or the other, but you do have to decide what's more important.
And when you say be happy, do you mean get married?
Yeah.
Plan on having a family?
Yes.
Be nice to people.
Yes.
Have perspective rather than decide that you're going to do everything you possibly can to get every single opportunity.
Yes. I think that I started to realize that there were people around me who had much less career-wise and were way happier. And there were people around me who had way more and were much less happy. And they had family and all of these other amazing things. And I realized that you kind of bow down before the god of your dream. A lot of us do in everything that we do. And when you have something that is so specific, like being on Broadway, which is why I say like kids shouldn't just focus on that one thing, it's very difficult. It's not just difficult because you have to be talented. It's difficult because roles and opportunities just don't come around so often. So you have to decide how to be happy today without that role. And for the last 10 years, really, after my mid-20s, you know, and since I was on Broadway in that first time and it wasn't there and I was back at BlackRock Financial, I realized that it was going to be much more beneficial to me to learn the skill of living in the in-between rather than the highs and the lows. And that just suits me. I enjoy living there.
Now, when you first started on Hamilton, your dressing room spot was right next to Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Right, yeah.
You've been close to people, you know, we talked about Book of Mormon, who are starting something, who have conceived of an idea that then bursts forth.
Right.
Onto the stage. Where is Lin going to be when the history of Broadway is written? Because,
yeah.
I mean, not only did he write it and stage, I mean, he played the lead role.
Right. It doesn't seem possible, right?
I mean, this has happened before, but has it?
Okay, it has happened before. People have done this, but not in a way that you're going to remember forever.
Yeah, like, do you know who? Because I'm not a...
It's so funny. I just did a benefit for Joel Grey, and there was this man, Anthony Newley, who wrote Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, and he starred in it, and he wrote it. I think he directed it, too. There are a lot of very incredibly talented people on Broadway, and there always have been. And there's a lot of writers who can sing, who are really wonderful performers. But there aren't that many who could do what Lin did on a stage.
Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable to me. And not only do it, but do it with such enthusiasm. And I don't know, I was next to him for almost 4 months, and it was the last 4 months of his run in a show that is very demanding. I did not hear that man complain once.
Okay, this is, I got to, I meant
not
to
once.
Ask.
It was, I mean, annoying.
For us in the audience, it's like a singular experience. Or if
right.
you call Quintanilla, who co-anchors with me on Squawk Alley.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he's seen it 6 times, so it's not exactly singular.
But right.
he's like one of a handful of times.
I think he's in the cast.
He should be by now.
Yeah.
But for you, I mean, you have literally done this show more than 100 times, right?
Almost 300.
Almost 300
just since,
times.
Yeah, just since
yeah, cause
I got there 9 months ago.
How hard is that? Because not only must it be mentally demanding mm-hmm. to be playing this character who's having this experience for the one and only time.
Right.
But you got a voice to take care mm-hmm. of, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there must be all kinds of limits that you got to observe. You've got to... I mean, people must get on your nerves every once in a while. How do you maintain through that many days and weeks end to end of performing?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously with this show, I have very little stage time compared to everybody else, so I can never complain about being too tired. Though, you know, 300 shows in, I don't really care how much time you're on stage, you can go crazy. That's definitely the biggest challenge on Broadway. And certainly I felt it with Book of Mormon in those 2 years. I did the show 800 times, and I was in, you know, 17 costume changes, 3 different characters, almost every other song I was either dancing or singing in. So it was way, way, way more taxing. And I would say the biggest challenge to every Broadway performer is not going crazy because of the schedule and keeping your stamina and your health going. It's not about learning how to play the character, because you do that pretty much right off the bat in rehearsal. It's about maintaining it so that those people who are coming at your 257th show are seeing it for the first time and they feel like you've never done it before.
Do you have to change something in order to do that? Because I imagine if you say or do the same thing over and over again, wouldn't you numb out eventually and just kind of like you're driving and you
That's exactly what the example I use. It's like when you drive home, you pull in the driveway and you think, oh my God, how did I get here?
Right.
I hope I didn't kill someone. You know, that real fear that you have, that happens on stage to us. That you will be singing and then I'll be thinking, oh wait, who am I meeting after the show? Where am I going? And then you're like, oh wow, I should probably think about what's coming out of my mouth in front of 1,300 people. And that's not a good thing. Because not only is it not giving you your best performance, although I doubt anyone in the audience would notice the difference with a Broadway performer, but it steals away the joy from yourself of what you love doing. I think that you kind of hit that brick wall and then you reassert yourself and renew yourself in the show.
Do you decide to put a motion in that you hadn't done before somewhere?
No.
Do you change? No, you don't change something.
No, you can't change. You know, everything changes on its own organically, and you always have a director or a choreographer trying to keep you within the rails so that you don't go too far out of the boundaries that we've all created. And it's a machine, you know, like there's 30 other people trying to do their job. So you can't like make these, you know, choices that throws everybody else off. It's going to be different every night just because it's different people on that stage. And you can't, like I was saying with Groff, like you can't recreate another person. You can't recreate exactly what you did the night before. It's impossible. So everything changes and adapts. But when you get to that point where you're really running into the brick wall, I just go over every scene before I go on, make myself present, remember what my intention is as the character, and just really commit to the storytelling. It's always about the story, and it's always about making sure you remember what part of the story you're telling at that moment. Mm.
If you have a performance that's not your best performance,
mm-hmm.
maybe it's even whatever your standard of bad is.
Sure.
Which probably for most people wouldn't notice, but what do you do? Do you focus in on what went wrong? Or at this point, do you say, it's going to happen, we'll just move on?
Well, what went wrong is usually not something that happened at the theater. It's, I didn't get enough sleep. I need to, you know, I wasn't much of an athlete growing up, but I think that being on Broadway is the closest to an athlete that I'll ever be. In that you really do have to maintain your stamina and your energy and your voice. And, you know, you can't stay in the loud bar too long. You realize that talking over a bar of people will set you back the next day in a show. And so, and you have to warm up for a half an hour vocally. You have to stretch. You have to be prepared. And so if something goes wrong on stage, it's not usually anything more after hundreds of shows than you just weren't prepared with your stamina.
So you go back and you figure out,
yeah,
what did I do if you didn't know already?
Yeah.
And then you
Yeah, if something goes wrong, you know, usually you know right away what you've done.
Well, Rory, this has been great. I appreciate you coming out.
Thanks for having
me. And
I have one last story for you you'll like. So I'm in Hamilton, right, for about a month, and I had just left Nerds, the musical, playing mm-hmm. Bill Gates.
So this is like May?
Yeah, exactly. It was in May. And Mark Zuckerberg comes to the show and brings a guest, Melinda Gates. And they come back, and they are wonderful. They are so nice. And I meet Melinda Gates, and I'm thinking, I just played her husband. In a, you know, almost a Broadway show. And I thought, should I say something to her? And then I said, I've got to say something.
Right.
So I said, first of all, you're an amazing humanitarian. You are an astounding human being. I just did all this research on you because I was playing your husband in a musical that was going to go to Broadway, Nerds. And she said, oh, we heard about that. And I died because I thought, that would never reach the radar of Bill Gates. You know, we kept saying, would you think they know about this?
Now I'm thinking, is that why the investor backed
out? I know. I highly doubt that that's what the situation was.
No.
But I said, don't worry. It was, you know, all in humor with love. I don't know if he would feel that way. But she said, well, I'm glad you're in this one.
So any other moments like that? I mean, I'm sure all kinds people.
Yeah, no, David Letterman came, and to me that was, there have been so many people that I could go through and name that it's insane. But David Letterman coming to me was, I don't know, I hate to say it, but it was like Johnny Carson coming. That, to me, is who that man is. And I just never thought I would have a chance to meet him, let alone have him see me in something, get to take a picture with him and tell me I did a good job. You know, you're sitting on your couch watching a comic do his thing for your whole life, and getting to have that moment with him was pretty spectacular.
And so I got to ask, since you mentioned the whole Mike Pence thing.
Yeah.
Was it weird to become a part of a national political conversation because of a president-elect's tweet? I mean, while continuing to do a show every night.
Yeah, it was weird. It was weird. I was like, I think the president-elect has tweeted more about Hamilton than I have, at least this week. But yeah, it was strange. You know, I thought that that the vice president-elect's response was just, like, really great, and that, you know, and that if you were in that room, I think you would understand why we felt like we had to say something. The audience reaction was negative, you know. I mean, it was like, you have to address something.
In the beginning,
yes.
Before the musical even started.
Yes, yes. And it was 8 days after the most contentious election ever. So it was... I think that, you know, a very, like, good thing that was something with some words were put behind something, you know, that it was fear. And, you know, that's what, no matter who was going to win, there was going to be a lot of fear, anxiety. And I think that the best thing about the show is that it shows our country that we have been struggling for freedom and how to govern ourselves from the very beginning, and that is that it is messy, it is difficult, and that generations before us literally fought wars. We will get through anything, and we can do it through debate and civil discussion, and it's important to have it even when it's messy.
And art.
And it's art has always played a huge part of it, and theater is a huge part of it, and you know it's what we're here for. But it was a very eye-opening experience in many ways, but just another amazing thing that this show has brought to me. And yeah, it's just all the different parts of culture that Hamilton has been a part of in the last year and a half since it opened on Broadway it's crazy.
Well, to quote Melinda Gates, I'm glad you're in this one.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Melinda.
My thanks to Rory O'Malley. Rory's done playing King George on Broadway after nearly 400 performances, but he's not done with the role entirely. All I can say about that right now is watch the headlines, and he's moving back to California. Hint, hint. I'm John Fort from CNBC, and this has been Fort Knox, Rich Ideas and Powerful People. Subscribe on iTunes, Apple's podcast app, or wherever fine podcasts are distributed. Check out Fort Knox Live on Facebook, Twitter, and Periscope, usually Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. I tackle the biggest business and economic issues of the week with a little help from my friends at CNBC and from you. Next week's theme for the podcast, the Consumer Electronics Show. I'm going to be there in Las Vegas interviewing some of the top tech CEOs, and I'm bringing you along. Meanwhile, share this, tell a friend, drop me a note on Facebook, Twitter, or fortknox.com. That's FORTTKNOX.com. And as always, thanks for lending an ear.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.